The missile crashed into the cliff face, gouging out a great fall of rock and filling the pass behind the Hercules with dust and smoke. Sean brought the Hercules back on even keel once again, gentling her, favouring her damaged wing. "Any sign of the hind?" "No." Joe broke off as he saw the dread shape materialise through the dust and smoke. "She's there. She's still coming." The entire rear section of the hind's fuselage was twisted askew, and half her rudder was missing. She staggered and lurched through the air, only barely under control, and falling rapidly behind the fleeing Hercules. The pilot was a brave man, serving her, keeping her in action to the end. "He's fired again," Job cried, as he saw the missile drop from under the stubby wing roots and boost towards them on a tail of smoke. "She's down!" Job watched the tail rotor of the gunship break away and spiral upwards, while the body dropped like a spine-shot buffalo and bull and hit the trees, breaking up in a tall burst of flame and smoke. "Break right!" Job called desperately. Although the hind was dead, her terrible offspring blazed across the sky, bearing down on them mercilessly. Sean put the Hercules over as hard as she could. The missile almost missed the turn and went skidding wide in overshoot. But it corrected itself and came around hard, spinning out a long billow of silver smoke behind it, and it fastened on the starboard number 2 motor. For a moment they were blinded as the smoke of the explosion swept over the canopy and was as suddenly swept away. The Hercules convulsed as though in agony. The missile blast threw her wing up, miraculously knocking her back into even keel, and adroitly Sean held her there. He looked across in horror at the damage. The number 2 engine was gone, blown out of its mountings, leaving a terrible gaping wound in the leading edge of the wing. It was a mortal blow. In her death throes, the Hercules careered across the sky, dragged around by the overpowering thrust of her port engines, the damaged wing flexing and beginning to fold backwards. Sean eased back the throttles, trying to relieve the strain and balance the thrust. He looked ahead, and there was the river, wide and shallow and tranquil above the turmoil of the falls. The first rays of the sun were buttering the tops of the trees on either bank, and the crocodiles lay black on the white sandbanks. Sean flipped on the internal tannoy and spoke over the loudspeakers into the cargo hold. "Hold on! We're going to hit hard," he said in Shangani, and pulled his own harness adjustment in tighter. The Hercules lumbered down heavily, both wings so badly damaged that Sean was amazed that she was still airborne. "Too fast," Sean muttered. She was dropping like an express elevator. They would hit the trees short of the river. He braced himself to lose a wing with disruption of airflow and gingerly pulled on full flap to slow her down. Far from destroying herself, the Hercules responded gratefully to the additional lift and floated in with a semblance of her old elegance. She skimmed the treetops on the riverbank, and Sean switched off the fuel pumps, mains and magnetos to prevent a fire. He held the nose high, bleeding off speed, and the needle on the airspeed indicator wound back sharply. The stall warning buzzer sounded, and then the deafening klaxon of the landing gear chimed in, trying to warn him that his wheels were still up. The controls went sloppy as the Hercules approached the stall, but they were out in the centre of the river, 20 feet up, dropping swiftly. The crocodile slid off the sandbar directly ahead, churning the green water in panic, and Sean kept feeling the control panel back and back, fending her off until the last possible moment. He felt the tail touch the water, and the airspeed indicator was right down to 40 knots. The Hercules stalled and belly-flopped into the river. A solid green wave broke over the nose and washed the canopy, spurting in through the bullet holes. Both Sean and Joe were flung forward violently against their shoulder harnesses, and then the Hercules bobbed up and surfaced on her belly, slowing down and turning to stop, broadside to the current. "Are you all right?" Sean barked to Job. For reply, Job unbuckled his harness and leapt out of the co-pilot's seat. The deck was canted under Sean's feet as he stood up. Through the canopy, he saw the Hercules was floating down aimlessly on the current. Her empty fuel tanks and the air trapped in the fuselage were keeping her afloat. "Come on!" He led Job back into the main hold and saw at a glance that the cases of missiles were still secured in their heavy cargo nets. The Shanganis were in a panic, at least two of them injured, writhing and moaning in the puddles of drying vomit on the deck, one with a sharp, jagged end of a bone protruding through the flesh of his broken arm. Sean spun the locking wheel on the emergency hatch and kicked it outwards. Immediately the nylon escape chute inflated and popped out like a drunkard's yellow tongue to flop onto the surface of the water below. Sean leaned out of the open hatch. They were drifting towards another sandbar, and he judged that the water under their keel was only shoulder deep, for he could see the bottom clearly. "Ferdinand?" Sean picked him out of the mob of milling Shanganis. "This way, get them out." He saw Ferdinand sober and lash out at the panic-stricken troopers around him, driving them towards the hatch. "Show them how it's done," Sean ordered Job, "and once you're down, get them to haul the hull into the sandbar." Job folded his arms over his chest and jumped feet first into the chute. He shot down into the water and then floundered to his feet. The water came up to his armpits, and immediately he waded to the Hercules' side and threw his whole weight against it. One at a time, the uninjured Shanganis followed him down the chute, and at the bottom, Job took charge of them. Sean shoved the last trooper through the hatch and then leapt out himself. The water was just a few degrees below blood warm, and as soon as he surfaced, he saw that all the men were straining against the Hercules' floating carcass and slowly moving her across the flow of the river. He added his own weight to theirs, and gradually the bottom shelved beneath their feet, and the water dropped to the level of their waists. The belly of the Hercules ran aground, and she settled heavily as the fuselage flooded. The men dragged themselves onto the sandbar and collapsed in sodden heaps, their expressions dull and bovine from the after-effects of terror and exertion. Sean looked around him, trying to assess their position and plan his priorities. The Hercules was stranded high enough to ensure that only the lower part of the fuselage was flooded and that the missiles could not be submerged and have their delicate electronic circuitry ruined. The current had swept them in under the sheer river bank, and the summer floods had piled dead trees and driftwood high against it. The sandbar was merely a narrow strip below the bank. "We must move fast," Sean told Job. "We can expect that the Hind was able to transmit a signal to the rest of the squadron, and they'll come looking for us." "What do you want to do first?" "Unload the stingers," Sean answered promptly. "Get them busy." Once Sean climbed aboard again, he found that the hydraulic rams on the cargo door were still operating off the batteries, and he lowered the ramp. The weight of each wooden case was stenciled upon it. 152 pounds. "They're light. Two men to a case," Sean ordered, and he and Job lifted them onto the shoulders of each pair as they stepped forward. As soon as they received it, they trotted down the ramp into the sandbar and up the bank into the trees. Ferdinand showed them where to stash them and cover them with driftwood. It took less than 20 minutes to unload the cargo, and every minute Sean was in a ferment of impatience and anxiety. As the last case was carried ashore, he hurried out onto the ramp and peered up at the sky, expecting to hear the approaching whine of rotors and Isotov turbos. "Our luck isn't going to last," he told Job. "We must get rid of the Hercules." What are you going to do? Swallow it or bury it? Job asked sarcastically. Against the forward bulkhead of the Hercules hold was a 120-ton loading winch used to drag cargo aboard. Under Sean's instruction, four Shanganis ran out the winch cable and used the Hercules inflatable life raft to take the end of it across the river and shackle it to a tree on the far bank. While they were doing this, Sean and Job searched the Hercules and stripped it of every item of useful equipment, from the first aid kit to the stores of coffee and sugar in the tiny forward galley. With satisfaction, Sean saw that the tropical first aid box was substantial and contained a good supply of malarial prophylactics and antibiotics. He sent it ashore with one of the Shanganis and ran back to the loading ramp. The dinghy was returning, and there was still no sign nor sound of marauding Hind gunships. It was too good to bear thinking about. "Get everybody ashore," Sean told Job, and went to the winch controls. As he engaged the clutch, the steel cable came up taut, and the Hercules' hull, which was heavily beached on the sandbar, lurched and began to swing. He kept the winch running, and the sand gritted and scraped under her belly as she was dragged by her own winch into deeper water. As soon as she was afloat, Sean half-closed the ramp to prevent her flooding too rapidly and winched her into the middle of the river, where the current was swiftest. As soon as she took the current and began to drift downstream, Sean grabbed the bolt cutters from their track on the bulkhead and sheared the cable. The Hercules floated free. On an impulse, Sean cut a 4-foot length from the end of the severed winch cable, and the stainless steel strands immediately began to unravel of their own accord. He rolled 3 of the separate strands into a tight loop and slipped the roll into his back pocket. Job would fit hardwood buttons to the strands. The garrotting wire was one of the scout's favourite clandestine weapons, and Sean had felt half naked since he had lost his in his pack that he had dropped down the cliff. He transferred his full attention back to the Hercules. "The fuel tanks are almost empty," he murmured as he watched her progress downstream. "She should float until she reaches the falls." He stayed on board while at least 2 miles of river bank went by. In the meantime, he used the bolt cutters to sever the hydraulic pipes and fuel leads that ran along the roof of the cargo hold. A mixture of hydraulic fluid and avgas dribbled and spurted and puddled onto the floor of the hold. Satisfied at last that he had done everything possible to throw off the pursuit, he balanced in the open escape hatch and pulled the pin from the phosphorus grenade that he had commandeered from Ferdinand. "Thanks, old girl," he spoke aloud to the Hercules. "You have been a darling. The least I can offer you is a Viking's funeral." He rolled the grenade down the deck of the hold and then leapt out of the hatch and hit the water. He came up swimming, reaching out in a full overarm crawl, with the image in his mind of those fat black crocodiles he had seen on the sandbar. Behind him he heard the muffled bump of the exploding grenade, but he never paused nor looked back until he felt the ground under his feet. By then the Hercules was a 1/4 mile downstream, burning furiously but still afloat. Black, oily smoke boiled up into the clear morning sky. Sean waded the last few yards to the steep bank and crawled up onto it on hands and knees. While he sat there panting and gulping for breath, he heard the familiar and by now well-hated sound of rotors and Isotoff turbo engines coming in fast. The smoke of the burning Hercules was a beacon that the Hinds would have spotted from 50 miles out.